touched down in the village of the bomb. Johnny touched down. Johnny touched down in the village of the bomb. Just another day neath the Afghan sun in the village of the bomb. Johnny got his gun where the Pashtun run. Johnny got his gun. Johnny got his gun where the Pashtun run. Manitoba boy, he was 21 when Johnny got his gun. Johnny got his gun at 21 while the pipes they played and a tiz did run. Said she'd wait till the kingdom come when Johnny got his gun. Johnny knew his way through the Panju way. Johnny knew his way. Johnny knew his way through the Panju way. Chasing down shadows that faded away in the Panju way. Johnny knew his way through the Panju way. Steady as they come, he wasn't there to play. Waiting back home neath the prairie sun, yeah, Johnny knew his way. Took it on the arm and up to the knees. Johnny in the lead. Johnny in the lead hit the ID. And they medevaced him out to Germany. She was waiting back home neath the prairie sun. Johnny in the lead. In the village of the bomb, life goes on. In the village of the bomb. In the village of the bomb, life goes on. With the squawking of the chickens when the soldiers come. In the village of the bomb. In the village of the bomb, life goes on. And all the king's horses can't help Johnny run. And all the king's men are hunkered down in the village of the bomb. In the village of the bomb, life goes on. It's been this way since time begun. It's just another day neath the Afghan sun in the village of the bomb. It's just another day neath the Afghan sun in the village of the bomb. It's just another day. The Afghan sun.
That's Charlie Angus and the Grievous Angels with Village of the Bomb from their 2013 album, The Great Divide. Now, Charlie Angus and the Grievous Angels have been making great Canadian roots music with a strong social conscience message for more than two decades now. After taking a break from recording for nearly a decade to pursue a political career, Charlie Angus, who is now the Member of Parliament for his home region of Timmins-James Bay, put the band back together to record their seventh album, The Great Divide, in 2013. The Great Divide is a haunting, heartbreaking and fun ride across the great northern plains of Canada. We caught up with Charlie in Cobalt, Northern Ontario, to chat about his music. So it's great to talk to you today, Charlie.
It's great to be on the show.
Well, I'm very pleased to get this interview. I've actually wanted to get it for a while, and now we're chatting. I have to say, I'm going to be completely clear with everybody listening at home. I'm a great fan of your politics as well as your music. I personally think there should be more politicians with a musical background in Parliament in Ottawa. So I do feel very lucky to have you there. But the conversation we're going to have is very much going to focus on your music, but also how that weaves into the direction that you've taken your life in with the fact that you're now Member of Parliament for Timmins-James Bay. I'd like to start the conversation today, though, that take everybody back to how you got started in music. I know you are a member of La Tronche, the punk band in Toronto, but just tell us how you started and then how you ended up with La Tronche.
I was in grade 8, grade 9, made a decision I was going to learn how to play guitar, and I met Andrew Cash that summer, We were 14 years old. We had two really bad guitars that were hard to play, and we decided that we were going to learn how to play, and then we were going to quit school and go on the road. And that's pretty much what we did. In the intermediate period of that, the punk rock explosion happened and made us think, even though we were very terrible musicians and couldn't sing, that yes, it really was possible, and that was how it started. And we went at it with a real single-minded focus that we were going to get better, that we were going to have something to say. And so we got a 69 Econoline, started hitting the bars across southern Ontario and out into the east.
Now, we're not going to have any time to play any of the music from L'Étranger today, but can you, in a few words, just describe what the music was like? It'll give people perhaps a teaser to check out some of the music you made in your early days.
Well, I think we were probably the beginning of the second wave of punk that hit the Toronto, southern Ontario scene. We were obviously very influenced by what was happening out of England, more so than the States. So, politically, very similar to the Clash, a lot of the kind of pop influences of the Jam. But I think what was different about us is we went for the big choruses, big harmonies, and that probably reflected stuff we grew up listening to. Andrew was a big Neil Diamond fan. We were Neil Young fans, so we started bringing in acoustic music very early in the L'Étranger scene. So there was an interesting transition when punk really shifted to alternative roots, and I think because of my background, I was very well placed to make that shift at that time.
Now, the Angels, I think, got together in the 80s. Was that your idea? I mean, did you decide that you wanted to get back into music? How did that happen?
I had left L'Étranger, and Andrew went on to Island Records. I was working with the homeless in Toronto, so I was still very young then. And I started the Angels really just as something for fun. My background, again, growing up, my family are Scottish and from Cape Breton, and they were miners in Northern Ontario. And we grew up on the Saturday Night Cayley. So the music I really, really loved and I was starting to explore again was those old Irish Scottish ballads, the Clancy Brothers, the Dubliners. My mom was a real old-style country music fan, Hank Williams. So the Angels started out really for fun. Let's explore some of this old music. Let's street bus. We'll make some money for beer. And the next thing we knew, we were playing music festivals across the country. So I hadn't started out with the Angels to be a writer or to use the music to tell anything. It was just to explore roots music that I had sort of grown up with as a kid. And I think those influences are still very much there today.
And I think at the start, am I right in thinking that you were just started out busking together as a group and then eventually decided to develop it more? Is that how things happened?
It was really supposed to be just fun, getting out on the weekends, busking on the street, making some beer money. At that time, it was Michelle Rumble, fantastic singer, who'd come to me and said, can we do something? Peter Gillard joined soon after, Tim Hadley. And then I began to write a very, very focused songs. And so we switched from sort of a fun party band, again, to a band that was starting to sing about the blue-collar life in Canada. I was starting to, at that time, think of leaving Toronto and moving back to Northern Ontario. So really, I've always been interested in working people. No offense to middle-class people, but I find upper middle class people to be fairly boring. Why would I write songs about them? I like blue collar life and the people and the tragedies and the difficulties they face. So the Angels, I think, morphed very early on from what was supposed to be just, accordion, stand up bass, and a fun sing along band into eventually what became the Angels sound of today.
Now, I think the albums you produced in the late 80s, early 90s, I mean, they really seem to have a very cohesive sound. And I think there was a strong suggestion at that time that the Angels were probably going to step up to a higher level. Is that right?
Well, yeah, we were the next big thing. We had released Toot La Gang was really just a bunch of demos. It was never meant to be a proper recording. But there was so much pressure for product. And that sold extremely well. We went into the studio and recorded One Job Town. That was a very, very focused album. We did all the artwork ourselves, that sort of almost iconic image of Michelle at the side of the road with the little girl who turned out to be my daughter. The sound, the everything was really focused, and we were getting a lot of interest in Europe. But music is, it never follows a linear path. Michelle was very unhappy in the band and left, and we had an album that was built entirely around her voice, and so we went on tour without a female singer. We had a couple of other women that sang with us, and then we tried to keep on that path. I really liked the idea of duets. I liked the female male vocal stylings, but it just didn't work. We couldn't keep a coherent band other than the four guys that were basically the Angels, and I just didn't have a commercial voice, so we sort of went to ground and went back to Northern Ontario and started just playing for the love of it and sort of gave up the notion of trying to make it successfully. And so there was a moment when we might have been something other, but that's life.
And I think at the same time, I mean, you've already hinted at the fact that you've always had a strong social conscience working with the homeless early on in Toronto. Being concerned about issues that affect the working person, the working individual. When you went back up north, I think that was the time that you really got involved in, you know, community action and trying to challenge some of the things that you perceive to be, you know, blights on our social landscape. Can you talk about that?
Well, I moved back to Northern Ontario. I moved up to this little mining town of Cobalt just as all the mines were shutting down, the grocery store was shutting down, the high school was shutting down. I was moving right into a Grievous Angel song. I didn't have political aspirations at that time, or I just thought I would, you know, find some work. We would write Grievous Angel songs, I'd carry on. But I began to get involved at that time. In the early 90s, there was this huge push to turn my region of Northern Ontario into a waste depository for urban garbage, for toxic waste, for incinerator plant, PCBs. And it was a real eye-opener to me that these areas, such as a depressed region of Northern Ontario, they're specifically targeted because they're seen as political have-nots. They're seen as, actually, the term is a sacrifice zone where you can send waste and you can set up the system so that local voices will not be heard. The backroom boys, the big lobbyists, the money will make sure that these things go ahead. And it just didn't seem to be right. So I got more and more involved in the fight against, at that time, the Adams Mine. And it pretty much derailed the Angels' career again because I was on the front lines of that battle, organizing, spending all my summers at community halls and legions organizing people. We ended up winning that battle. It was a 14-year fight, and it really taught me a lot about brass-knuckle politics. It taught me just what kind of opposition there is to basic democratic, the rights of citizens to be heard in a democratic way on issues about environment, about toxic waste, about development. So I came out of that probably a lot politically harder than I may have been. And also, once again, it seemed I'd managed to derail the Grievous Angels' struggling career by spending so much time on these issues.
Now, I think you pulled the Grievous Angels back together in 2003, right? Because I think that was when Hanging Songs came out?
Yeah, we came out for Hanging Songs. So that song was carried some of those influences of what I was seeing politically. It was also in the, you know, right after 9/11, and this whole realization of this neocon assault on our planet and our democratic institutions. So Hanging Songs had some of those elements, as well as the classic, Grievous Angel stories of heartbreak and loss, like songs like something about a barmaid, the way a barmaid moves at midnight was right in there, along with another very political song like Hanging Songs.
Now, in 2004, that was when you were elected to Parliament as the new Democratic Party member for Timmins, James Bay. Can you talk a little bit about that time? I'm always fascinated to know when, you know, you have that sudden career change, how much angst actually goes into it. And my sense is that you are realizing that, you know, you had you had the ability, I think, to be a strong parliamentarian, but also, and you had obviously a very strong social conscience. Was there a period of real questioning, you know, do I decide to go in this direction now, or do I stay with my music? Because, you know, I still have this strong passion for using that as the tool to talk to the people.
I'd never really considered a life in politics. The NDP were pushing me for years while I was fighting the toxic waste fight to run provincially, and I just thought it was a crazy lifestyle. I'd be away from home. I wasn't actually at that time all that comfortable going out as a public figure on political issues. I liked organizing. I liked being the one who was helping do the planning. But one of the big influences at that time was Jack Layton. I really had gotten to know Jack Layton well during the whole fight on the garbage issue. And Jack made me think that it was actually possible to do politics with integrity, that it wasn't about selling out. And, I mean, the whole selling out thing was always the punk rock great fear, you know, any bit of success that it means you sell out. And I think that that's bogus. I think if you have integrity, if you have a grounding in a vision, winning actually isn't a problem. You should want to win because we want to start taking our country and our planet back from the people that we always defer to in these situations, who are often, you know, the accountants, the bankers, the lawyers who judge everything. Why not have a musician in there? And, so I put an election team together the way I would put a band together, and we went at it, and we were going to have a lot of fun doing it. And when I won, I put my staff together the way I'd put a, you know, kick-ass rock and roll group together. I wanted people who had fire in their belly, but who played well together, and never looked back. I think I'm more passionate about the work now than I was when I got elected.
Now, I didn't realize how big your constituency is, because it's huge. Before we came to air today, you told me that Timmins, James Bay, the constituency that you serve in the Canadian Parliament, is bigger than the whole of the UK. Is that right?
It actually, you could fit all of the UK into my riding.
Yeah, that is unbelievable.
But, you know, I love northern people. I love the since I've been elected, I've gotten to serve as the James Bay region and the Cree communities. So it's huge, but it's all very local. I know all my little towns. I know people in each of them. And so I literally live in my car. I'm never in an office when I'm in the riding. I'm always in the car. I'm always going to places. I'm always at restaurants to meet people or coffee shops. And it really is about public service, but these are the people I've written about. These are the people I continue to write about. Their stories are the stories that I bring to Ottawa. So I see that in some ways what I did with the Angels and what I'm doing in politics, the only difference is now I can afford a suit, and I wear a suit when I do it as opposed to a jean jacket.
And how does the music fit with the some of the other members of Parliament who, let's be honest, they must be a lot stuffier than you. You know, Andrew Cash is in there now as well, obviously. Which is still amazing, two members of a Toronto punk band in the Canadian Parliament. Tell us a little bit about the interaction with some of the other parliamentarians.
Well, I think I'm still very, I think you, when you come from, you know, the sort of the punk rock roots, the sense of, I don't take some of this stuff very seriously, the hoi polloi, I'm supposed to look up to my betters. I don't get that. That's one of the reasons I have so much fun fighting with the senators. They just believe that they're a better class of people, and I'm sorry, I don't really see any proof of that. So, but I think one of the things that you bring as a musician, like we're the ultimate DIY industry. Nobody ever made it in music that didn't really hustle, that didn't really believe that what they were doing had value. I used to say to bands that opened for us, if you don't believe you're the best band in the world, and if you don't believe you have something to say, then you shouldn't be on the stage. Same as a song. If I can't make that song my own, if I can't add something to that song that the original didn't have, then why would I sing it? So my voice in Parliament, I believe, is the same thing. I'm there to do a job. we're really very much organized. It's, to me, it's still very much like the punk rock ethos. I find it it still speaks to me.
Now, you put the band back together, I think, in 2011, you recorded Diamonds in the Snow with Andrew Cash. We're going to play that at the end of the interview today. But in 2013, that was when the Great Divide album came out, which is a lovely album. What I love is there's great story songs, there's great, you know, stories that talk about significant aspects of our history. We also have a strong political message in there about equality and, you know, trying to right some of the wrongs that have been forced on people over time. We started off with, though, the Village of the Bomb as the song we played first before we came to the interview today. Can you talk about that song?
Well, Village of the Bomb was the beginning, I think, of my rediscovery of the importance of the Angels and the importance of writing. At the time when I was in Parliament and the vote to send our troops into Kandahar, I noticed that suddenly in this country there's a real chill on speaking your mind. That you're being denounced all the time as an extremist, unloyal, unpatriotic. That this is how the conservatives bully people. They get people to shut down. We see the shutting down of so many of the environmental and human rights organizations that are afraid to speak up with this government. And at the time, I was really disturbed about what was happening with our increasing war in Afghanistan. And I was realized as a politician, it was hard to articulate it. It was hard to speak up. And also, I represent a region where a lot of our young people, working class people, are the ones who went to Kandahar. You know, the well-off didn't go. So I knew a lot of families whose sons and daughters were in Afghanistan. And so I wrote Village of the Bomb. And I could sing that, and people would come up to me. I'm four-term tour duty, a veteran from Kandahar came up to me and said, "That's the song about our experience. You told it the way it was." And that's as high as honors you'll ever get writing a song. So I found that songs became increasingly important to me as a way of speaking out in a culture where political language is becoming so devalued and so dumbed down. Songs are a way to break through.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate you sharing that. And certainly that song is very impactful. It's interesting that you decided to make that the first song on the album.
Well, I thought that there's something... I love Canadians, but as a nation, we're going along with some things that are really, really bad, and we're not reflecting on it. And we were in this horrific war for 12 years, and nobody has really analyzed why we were there, what we learned, or what happened coming out of it. And to me, that's what songs are able to do. Songs are always the first, to me, the voice that allows people to start to articulate something. So I thought that was the appropriate song to open the album with. You can take it however you want. You can apply whatever lessons you want out of it. But it just says it. And then let's get into the discussion about the other issues that are being raised on the album.
I'd like to take a break just now. I want to play the next song on the album, which is Four Horses, which has a story that I'm going to allow you to tell before we listen to it, because it's a very impactful song. It certainly, I think, speaks to a lot of the injustices that have been forced on our Aboriginal peoples. But tell us a little bit about that song, and then let's play that on Folk Roots Radio today.
Four Horses is the story of Canada's forced starvation, the plan of actually starving the Western Cree and Assiniboine, breaking a treaty obligation when the Buffalo failed, and that led to almost the destruction of the Western Cree on the plains under John A. Macdonald. This was deliberate government policy of using starvation. It mentions Poundmaker, probably one of the great Aboriginal leaders, who of course has never been taught in schools, about a battle at Cutknife Creek where Poundmaker spared all the soldiers, and the Canadian government in turn grabbed all the young Cree and hung them in the largest mass hanging in Canadian history. And what the Cree had been fighting for, they hadn't been fighting in a war. They had come into town because their children were starving and they were set upon by the soldiers. We're not taught these stories, and these are stories that, unless until we know where we came from, we will never be the nation that we need to be. And I was so shocked when I started to learn this history that I thought I knew this history. I thought I grew up knowing Canadian history, and I hadn't been taught this. I thought the one way to pass this on to a new generation is in song, because it's something that people will get. They'll either hear it and understand it, or they won't. So this is my attempt to set the historical record straight.
Let's play that song just now. This is Charlie Angus and the Grievous Angels from the album The Great Divide that came out in 2013, and Four Horses. And you're listening to Folk Roots Radio, and I'm Jan Hall.
Fort Capel came a dapple gray. His children caught blood in the autumn rains. Broke the treaty when the buffalo failed. Fenced the land for the CP rail. There's four horses at the Great Divide. Forget what they taught about the medicine line. It's just four horses at the Great Divide. Saw a black horse at Cut Knife Creek. But the great pound maker was a man of peace. Spared the soldiers, true to his word. So they hung the braves at the Battleford. There's four horses at the Great Divide. Forget what they taught about the medicine line. Like a storm on a distant sky. There's four horses at the Great Divide. White chief, hunger's a lesson that's so easy to teach. Kill a warrior, you need a gun in hand. To kill a people, you need a bureaucrat man. There's four horses at the Great Divide. Forget what they taught about the medicine line. Like a storm on a distant sky. There's four horses at the Great Divide. There's four horses at the Great Divide.
That was Four Horses by Charlie Angus and the Grievous Angels from the album The Great Divide. Charlie Angus, singer-songwriter, roots musician, MP for Timmins James Bay, is our guest on Folk Roots Radio today. It's been a wonderful conversation, Charlie. We're going to get to Diamonds in the Snow fairly shortly, but I want to talk a little bit about weaving the Grievous Angels into your current life. Do you feel like you get to play enough now that you have this very important career in Ottawa?
For the longest time, the only playing I would do would be at local country dances and at events where I get up with the local bands. But putting the Angels back in the studio, I was so proud to be able to. I love the band. These guys are such pros, and they put up with the fact that I don't call them for ages and ages and ages, and then I say, "Hey, do you want to do a show?" And they all show up. We did 12 days on the road last summer, which was fantastic. I couldn't sit on a beach for a vacation. It would drive me crazy. So we played out through the Calgary, Vancouver folk festivals and up through the mountains. And it was so inspiring to do that. I really wish I can find a way to integrate the Angels more. I'm writing lots of new material, looking to find a way to get us back in the studio. So we don't get to play as much as we would like. We don't get to travel the way we used to. But the guys are still very committed to it, and they really, the second we get together, the sound is very, very cohesive, and everybody's there to play. So it doesn't get any better than that, than to play with musicians that you love and respect.
Is there going to be much opportunity for you to play together this summer? You mentioned that you were able to be on the festival circuit in 2014. Opportunities in 2015 for you?
We don't have any yet. I'm a terrible manager of the band. I probably should have been on this a little before, because there were festivals we were hoping to get to, but I didn't send out the packages. But that's the story of the band's life. But, you know, we will be playing. I've got some new songs that the band's heard a few of them, and we're trying to find a way to carry this on. And also, that's a thing I've learned, is that music is a lifelong adventure. And I'm playing with guys that I've been playing with for over 25 years, and we still like each other. We still like to play. And the music is, to me, as relevant, or maybe even in some ways more relevant than what I was when we were younger. So the next Angels show will be when it is.
What does the future hold? Obviously, you're in Parliament. It's actually an election year this year. How do you see your career moving forward, both on the political side and the musical side?
I had thought that the Angels would be something I had to give up to become a politician, but I've realized that as I go further down this political path, the importance of finding ways to integrate music has become very, very clear to me. So we did the album in 2013. I also do other projects that take up my time, so I'm finishing a book right now that's taken most of last year in terms of my creative effort. It's a book called Children of the Broken Treaty, and it's a story of the systemic negligence against First Nation children by this government, and so that's taken up a lot of energy. Once that book's done, I think I'm going to get back into trying to work on some new material for the band, and I really feel, given the state our country's in and the way we're sliding down this slope of losing a sense of that special, undefinable characteristic of what made Canadians so tolerant and so open and so unafraid, I'm trying to put my finger on it lyrically so that I can explain what I'm feeling right now in my uncertainty about the nature of our country. So I'm hoping to get some songs on that topic and get the band back in the studio.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Well, look, it's been great to talk to you today. We're going to play Diamonds in the Snow to wrap this interview. That's the song that you recorded with fellow musician and MP Andrew Cash. That song has a bit of a message in it as well, and I'd like you to share that with our audience today.
I wrote Diamonds in the Snow after the Cree youth leader, Shannon Kustashian, died at the age of 15. She was this symbol of hope in our far north, fighting for school and communities where we have children being educated in crappy, rundown portables, no proper schools. And up in James Bay, right near the little shanty towns of Attawapiskat and Keshechewan, is one of the world's largest diamond mines. And so diamonds in the snow, the symbolism to me was Canada, again, will never be the country it was meant to be till it realizes that its real wealth isn't in the oil patch or in the gold or the diamonds. And we are blessed with enormous riches in this country. But that the real riches are these children whose lives are being squandered by government indifference in these reserves. Children who are not getting the basic rights to education, not getting basic support and special education when they need it. And what kind of nation squanders the future of its children? So Diamonds in the Snow, I wrote that song, and it's become the anthem of the movement for First Nation children's rights. I go to schools and school groups sing that song to me, which is pretty amazing feeling. I never thought I'd write a children's anthem, but this song has become an anthem that a lot of young students who are becoming activists over the issue of equal rights for Indigenous children, this song has become the song that helps push that movement forward.
You know, that's a great way to finish this interview. I want to thank you very much for sharing that story and also spending the time to talk to us today. If you want to learn more about the music of Charlie Angus, visit grievousangels.ca. And Charlie, if people want to talk to you about politics, about your drive for equality within this country, how can they get hold of you?
I live on Facebook. Every morning I'm on Facebook doing politics and music. I'm on a Southern Gospel kick right now on my Facebook page. So Charlie Angus NDP is the Facebook. I have three personal Facebook pages because there's two of them are full up with at the limit of friends. So I've started a third one called Charlie Angus NDP. So befriend me on Facebook. I try and get discussions going, let people know what we're up to. And again, tell people about life in the North and our communities. And there's lots of music.
Well, look, it's been a great pleasure talking to you today. We're going to leave you with Charlie Angus and the Grievous Angels with Andrew Cash and Diamonds in the Snow from the album The Great Divide. You've been listening to Folk Roots Radio, and I'm Jan Hall. And Charlie, that was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. What a treat.
in the snow. 'Cause you judge your life by what you can own. But they shine so bright, brighter than your gold. Little diamonds, diamonds in the snow. Through these diamonds in the snow, you threw them away, thought no one would know. Your world whole.